thank you for joining us today for the Fair Losophy podcast. We're going to be talking about everything related to fair trade fashion, including sustainability, ethics, human trafficking, our artisans, and keeping kids in school. My name is Jackie Costello, and I own the Golden Rule Boutique, an all fair trade boutique based in San Diego. My co-host is Jen Parlin, and she is a fair trade partner with Threads Worldwide based in Connecticut.
Today's episode features Caro of Dust Kelsa, a made-to-order fashion brand sewn here in the U.S., made of fabric woven in Guatemala and El Salvador. Welcome to the 16th episode. It's the week of Valentine's Day, which is a huge time for chocolate sales. Jackie and I encourage you to grab a bar of Fair Trade certified chocolate this year for your sweetie or your galentine or whoever, or just yourself. I mean, I'm actually holding a bar of my favorite Fair Trade chocolate, Tony's Chocolonely. Oh my God, they're so good. Their slogan is, "Together we make chocolate 100% slave-free," which is their vision for the chocolate industry as a whole. If you weren't aware, this industry is hugely known for exploiting people, so some of the major chocolate producers can profit. Doesn't that suck? Anyway, there are so many great fair trade options, so go grab a bar of fair trade chocolate if you're going to buy chocolate this year. We would also love to hear your feedback. What are your favorite brands? Have you shopped with any of the brands that we've featured on our podcast? Have you changed any of your buying habits? Small, big, we'd love to hear it all. And maybe there's someone that you'd like us to interview. Tell us. Hit us up on Instagram or Facebook. All right, well, enjoy today's chat. All right, Caro. Thank you so much for spending some time with me. Jackie and I are so excited that you could join us. So we'd love it if you could just introduce yourself to our audience.
Yes, so I am Lisbeth Carolina Arias, and I am the founder and CEO of Descalza, which is a handcrafted, made-to-measure clothing brand that collaborates with artisans in Latin America, especially Guatemala and El Salvador. And work with local seamstresses and manufacturers here in North Carolina to produce really unique statement pieces.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was looking at your website and I was completely obsessed with your designs. The colors are just so beautiful. And of course, you know, I was reading more about your story and a little bit about how you started. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about, I guess, whatever you want to share about it, but I know it's probably a long story is how it got started. but yeah, if you want to dive into to how the idea came about.
Yeah, so I think I majored in fashion textile design at school at NC State. And one of the opportunities I had there was to do an internship in Panajachel, Guatemala. And this was my sophomore year, the summer after my sophomore year. And those fabrics stayed with me, just the way that the women were working. And then just seeing my reflection in their work. So I was born in El Salvador, but I've been raised in North Carolina my entire life. So seeing them weave these fabrics kind of felt that they were weaving a part of my own history. Mm. Something that I had never been exposed to here in the United States. So I knew somehow I was going to be back in Latin America. I was going to be back with those women, with those textiles that were home to me, but I wasn't sure how. And so I played with the idea throughout undergrad. Any senior collection that we had to make, I always incorporated those textiles, but that was just a project for me. And then I graduated from NC State, left to New York, did the whole design experience up there, loved the city. I wasn't in love with the industry. I felt that I was being overworked, you know, as a typical grad student, you take anything that you can. You just need a job. You don't care [S2] Right. [S1] What it is that you're doing. You don't care how much you're getting paid, and you don't really understand that you have like values, and you have there are things that are important to you that you don't always have to compromise just for a job. And so New York definitely taught me that. And what I learned up there was that the people, my supervisor, my boss, the reason that they were making me work above and beyond was because they valued what I did, that I was good. Right. So I needed that validation. And once I got that, once I saw that other people thought I was capable of doing things like this, then I figured out, I was like, you know what, like, I'm young. If I can overwork myself for someone else's dream, why can't I do it for my own? Mm. And, you know, do something that I genuinely care about, and, you know, produce clothing that it won't be catered to the 1%, it'll be catered to people that look like me. Mm. So then I decided to come back after a year in New York. I came back to North Carolina, and I started working on the idea of Descalza.
Wow. So when was this? How long ago did this start?
Yeah, so I came back to North Carolina in 2016. Okay. And in 2017 was when we launched the Kickstarter, which kind of, you know, blew everything up.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the Kickstarter campaign and how you decided to go that route?
Yeah, so I was very unfamiliar with crowdfunding. I wasn't sure what that looked like. And I had been told that if you want to start a business, you need at least $10,000 in your account. And mm. I just graduated from school. I have $10,000 of debt.
right?
But I don't have any of that money in my account. And for me, you know, money is something that I never really had. But it's never stopped me. I've always found a way to make things work. And so I was sharing the idea with one of my friends, and he told me about the concept of Kickstarter and how it worked. And so I was like, yeah, let's do it. So I got, you know, my business friend, I got, you know, two of my friends that are into cinematography and videography. And the summer of 2017, we went to El Salvador, and we, you know, took shots of Don Chepe, our artisan, weaving the fabrics, you know, recorded things here in North Carolina, just kind of literally capturing both communities, both cultures, making an amazing video out of it, just, you know, summarizing what the story was about, why we were doing this. And I just found the most interesting ways to get people on board on the Kickstarter, because, you know, it's one thing to send an email to somebody, but it's another thing of, you know, having them be a part of this. So I think that's what really helped with us with our Kickstarter, was that once, you know, we had a backer on board, we were trying to find them ways for them to also be a part of this journey, that they weren't just a backer. So we gathered a community of about 269 people. They all pitched in, they all did their part, and we raised over $20,000 in 1 month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been such a good feeling to see that, like, happening.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was just because, I mean, I don't have experience with fundraising. I didn't have any experience with Kickstarter. But I think already from the beginning, I was learning that, you know, when you don't feel like you're an expert in something, you find someone that does feel like they are, or they do feel confident in that area. And when you get, like, the best parts of everyone, like, it just, you make things happen. And for me, I've always been a true believer of, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And for someone that didn't start with anything, any sort of funding, and then in 1 month we had $20,000 already, it's like, you can find a way to make it happen. You just have to be very creative about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that, because I feel like we don't do things that we really want to do sometimes because we're afraid, or that we feel like we don't know how to do them. Mm-hmm. And so we're like, all right, well, you know, I don't really know how to do that, so I'm not going to do it. So that's really cool and inspiring that, you know, you made it happen. Mm-hmm. Like, that's awesome. So so then what happened after you raised the $20,000? Like, what, how did that turn into the business?
Yeah, so the beauty about Kickstarter is that you can kind of test your product out to the market without having to spend a lot of money. And so what we did was I had already a prototype, like a sample collection, and that's what we were selling on the Kickstarter. And what people backed were their own skirts. And so with the money, we used it to start our first production line. And then also, you know, just get the logistics ready for just, you know, starting a business, setting accounts up and all of that good stuff. And when I saw that past the Kickstarter, people were still requesting these skirts. I was like, you know what? This is more than a project. This is more than just a Kickstarter project. This is a business.
Yeah.
And so the following year, I spent majority of my time just setting up our website or e-commerce, working more on an elaborate collection that wasn't just two skirts and a tie. It was, you know, several skirts, you know, a dress, a top, and a couple more ties and bow ties for the guys.
Right.
And yeah, and so every year we grow a little bit more. It's, you know, I'm doing this very grassroots style. It's mostly just me working on everything. I have a couple of helpers. So it's a slow and steady flow, but every year we learn more and we do better.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love that. And I read a little bit about how you incorporated your mom. Yeah, can you just tell us a little bit about that? That's so cool. I love
that. Yeah. So my mom, oh my gosh, this lady, she's like the sweetest little soul walking around this earth. Her first job here in North Carolina when we got to the States was a seamstress. And I would watch her, you know, growing up, I'd watch her just make these things, make these clothes, just work the sewing machine. And I was always interested in what she was doing. And so I think that's where it comes from. Like, you know, the concept of making it was hereditary. I got it from my mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up in a household where I was the only one that spoke English, I was the only one going to school. My mom felt that she truly wasn't able to help me and be on my support until I started my apparel classes. And I'd be like, Ma, I'm learning how to sew a button. Can you help me? She's like, yes, like I can help you with your homework. So that was something we could share together that, you know, didn't require English. You know, there wasn't no language barrier. I mean, when it comes to making, you speak with your hands. And so it was something that my mother and I could bond with. And now starting the business, like she's, you know, my biggest fan, and I still go to her for any sort of advice if it comes about like production and how to sew this or how to cut it. Or, you know, is this the right fabric for this type of product that we want to make? She's like my consultant. Mm. And you know, she keeps me in check as well. And so, yeah, it's crazy how, you know, just doing this business, like I'm just strengthening my relationship with my mom.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When did your mom come to the States?
So we both got here in 1994. So okay. She brought me here when I was two.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And you said you go back to El Salvador. Is this often? Is it business related or just to visit family?
Both. So I started going back when I was 16, and for the most part of my life, it was family. Most of my family's back home, so we would go most of the time for Christmas. Just, you know, Christmas and my birthday are like really close to each other, so we would do that. And then now, what I'll do is, you know, I'll break up my time. Half of the time I'll spend with my family and just like be present and live the moment. And then the other half I'll be with the artisans and, you know, just brainstorming and figuring out like what our next steps are.
Yeah, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to Guatemala. I haven't spent much time in Latin America. Mm-hmm. But I've visited some artisans that we work with at Threads Worldwide, in Ecuador. So this is like 2 years ago, and it's just such a beautiful country, and I love just all the fabrics that they use there, all the colors, and it's so beautiful. So I'm really excited about going to Guatemala to meet more artisans that we work with. And you spend time in Guatemala as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Guatemala's, it's my neighbor. And Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, like we all have a lot in common. So we easily, you know, connect with each other. So our fabrics tend to look a little similar, but the process, you know, slightly changes, our colors slightly change. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's very cool. And do you work with any other artisans in different countries?
At the moment, not yet, but I'm hoping to work with artisans in Mexico, all throughout, artisans in Peru, artisans in Ecuador. But right now I'm just sticking to the two countries that I know best.
Right, yeah. How did you find the artisans that you work with?
So the ones in Guatemala, I have a professor here who she has a really good friend who actually leads a cooperative in Guatemala. So I got connected with her and we bonded immediately and we were both on the same wavelength. And so she helps me out from the Guatemala side. And then in El Salvador, I was actually talking to my cousin right after I did my internship in Guatemala. I was like, I know there has to be something like this in El Salvador. Where is it? And she told me, she's like, all I can think of is this little town near the volcano in Santa Ana that has similar weaving looms. And kind of, she's like, I think this is what you're looking for. So we actually head up there. And I can hear it from the streets, the sound of the weaving loom, like somebody working it in the back. And so I just go in, like, if I know where I'm going. and there he is, Don Chepe, who's a really, like, good friend. He's become a friend.
Yeah.
He's back there, and he's weaving these fabrics. And I was like, I just immediately, we had a connection. And there's another woman, she leads the cooperative there, and so we, you know, connected through Facebook, and that's how I talked to them, is through Facebook. And yeah, they were really amazing. Like, he was kind of stunned. He was like, you're so young, why are you interested in this? Like, the kids here aren't.
Wow.
And I was like, I explained to him what this meant to me and what it meant to, you know, people who live in the States, but, you know, they still want to stay connected to their roots. So it was a little at first sight, if you can say.
Oh, I love that.
Mm-hmm.
And so how many artisans, is it just like one artisan in El Salvador and one artisan in Guatemala, or do you work with the entire cooperative?
So it depends how much we're requesting.
Right.
So in El Salvador, Don Chepe is the one that oversees all of it.
Okay.
So if he needs help, he gets about three or four artisans to help and pitch in. In Guatemala, there's a family, Don Manuel. It's him, his wife, and his two kids that help. And then if we're requesting more than what they're capable of in the short amount of time, whatever time frame we need it, then they'll get in some more artisans. But those are the two that we mostly work with, is Don Manuel and his family, and then Don Chepe in El Salvador.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you talked a little bit about fair trade on your website, and that's kind of what we center our podcast all around. So like when – I know you worked in the fashion industry – and I'm sure you saw a lot of things, but when did you start thinking about, was fair trade something you learned about in school, or is it something that you kind of discovered, I guess, just kind of dive into that?
Yeah, so I think fair trade came to me slightly different. So being from El Salvador, there's a stigma that in third world countries, like, people are helpless, that people are impoverished, that they aren't capable of taking care of themselves. So this is, you know, unfortunately, if you're not someone who's very outgoing, who's very open-minded, you have this idea that countries in Latin America they can't do anything without the States, or they can't do anything for themselves. And so for me, you know, growing up here in the States and hearing about that from about El Salvador and about, you know, or the other neighboring countries, it frustrated me because I would go back to El Salvador and I wouldn't see any of that stuff. Like, you don't see these poor little kids, you know, walking without a shirt on, without shoes on. Like, they're hustlers over there.
Right.
And so for me, it was like, when starting this Descalza, like, I wanted, you know, not to do any charity work in El Salvador, because I feel that charity isn't sustainable and it's not something, you know, what happens when you run out of money, when you are out of funds, like, what happens to the families and the working people back there? Like, do they have, they still have to live. They still have to find a way to make ends meet. And so in my mind, you know, from the start, it was like, you know, the concept of the Descalza, the whole purpose is to support and bridge both communities. If we're doing, you know, if we're properly paying our people and our manufacturers and our seamstresses here in North Carolina, there's no other way to do it but the same way in El Salvador and in Latin America. And speaking to the people that own the cooperatives and kind of move things around, like, they're like, yeah, that's what the artisans want. They don't want a monthly, you know, charity check that may come in or may not come in. Like, they want orders because they know that orders bring in a more, you know, an order brings in an income, which provides them an opportunity to sustain their families and to, you know, hopefully break out the system that, yeah, to be honest, like, in Latin America, it is a little harder. Opportunities aren't as available as they are here. Resources are very limited, but people can still find a way to make it happen. They can still find a way to make it work to the point where they don't feel like they need to immigrate to another place and leave their comfort. Yeah. And so that for me was like, you know, later on, like, I learned, okay, this is what fair trade is. Like, this is what, you know, most people speak about. But in my mind, it was like, no, like, I want to change the stigma that people have of Latin America. Like, we're not, you know, poor little kids walking in the street with nothing, you know, but, you know, the clothes that we have on our backs. We're hustlers, and we're doing the best with what, you know, the circumstances we are in.
Yeah. I love that you say that because it is true. Like, people do have these thoughts about, you know, developing countries and what that looks like. And I totally agree with you on the charity aspect of it. Like, I love that, you know, businesses like yours are creating sustainable income and it's not a charity. You're not just giving them something. You're empowering them to, you know, build a business themselves. And I think that the partnership between companies here in the States and companies wherever, it's like a true partnership. And with the work that I do, we've been kind of careful about how we speak about it, because it's like, we're not helping these people. Like, we're partners. Like, we can't do what we do without them. And they're badass. Like, especially the women that we hear about, I mean, they're really, they're overcoming things, you know, just like working as a woman, you know. It's a different kind of a culture and stuff that I've been learning about. I'm sure you know much more than I do, but it's like, just being a woman and earning your own money, and then you're showing your daughter that that's possible. It's really moving and empowering. And I think it's, yeah, just how we talk about it is important, is we're true partners. So I love that. I love that you say that. So did you see anything when you were working in New York that jumped out at you, like, wow, okay, this is the fashion industry?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, one of the things, there are a lot of things, but one of the things that struck out to me was the design process. And, you know, for me as a designer, there's intention in everything. And just like the artisans with the fabrics and any of the motifs that they use, there's an intention. There's a story behind it. They're just not putting pretty things together. So what I saw in New York was that, you know, the lead designer would look at another designer's work, change one thing about it, and then call it her own. And so I was really disappointed because, you know, in school they highlight this, they make this look, you know, they, you know, really praise these designers and say, you know, this is what they do. And then I'm in the environment, and I see that they're not doing anything that's creative, they're just, you know, trying to go as quick as they can. They see what, you know, what worked for another designer. They tweak one little thing. They're like, oh, now this is mine. This is an original. And I'm just like, this is boring. Like, this is not creative whatsoever. I'm pretty sure this is, like, this is cheating, you know?
Right.
And I know that, you know, now in design and in the fashion industry, you can't really create anything from scratch. Like, we're, you know, repeating everything. And that's okay. But I think that when you are putting things together, there has to be some sort of intention behind it. That's some sort of purpose behind it. And, you know, that's what differentiates art from design. You know, art, you can put pretty things together. If this is what feels right, then, you know, go for it. But in design, like, you have to think about your customer. You have to think about, you know, what's the final product and how is that going to impact the person wearing it.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Did you see anything in regards to, like, how the clothes were made here and how much money people are getting paid? And when you were designing in your internship, did you see any of the manufacturing, like, process, or were you a part of that at all, or was it mostly just design?
So I mostly stayed on the design side, but I knew a lot about what was going on overseas. And then even within being in the design side, I saw how a lot of the women that I was, like, connecting with, they were seamstresses, you know, they were pattern makers. They were Latinas, you know, they're in New York, you know, they were Colombian, they were Puerto Rican, so we'd speak Spanish.
Yeah.
And they would tell me, they're like, yeah, right before you have fashion week, right before you have any sort of launch of a collection, they are, you know, it's, the hours are very slim that they get to spend with their families. The hours are very slim that they get to have, you know, freedom. They have to stay there and they have to work until, you know, everything is done. And even when everything's done, if it's not approved, they have to keep working on it. So I'm just like, okay, mm-hmm. You know, I pulled all-nighters in college, but that was because, you know, it's college is what you do. You pull all-nighters because you have to get all this work done. But as a professional, like, I don't know, those, you know, light bulbs were turning on and I was just like, I don't think this is normal. But yeah, so I saw a lot of that. And I was shocked because this is like a professional. This isn't a startup. This is, you know, a company that's been up and going for years. Why haven't they figured this out and why are they doing it this way?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any insight on, like, how much they are getting paid?
I didn't ask.
Yeah. I'm just curious. We've had some conversations in the past about some of the factories in LA.
Mm.
And yeah, and how they were getting paid. And it's really interesting because we don't think that, you know, when it comes to fair trade, it's all about, like, sourcing our products from developing countries because we want mm-hmm. them to earn a fair living or fair wage. But there are people here in the States that aren't getting paid fairly. And it's, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's something we need to think about as well. So, mm-hmm. yeah. So I was thinking about, like, fast fashion and that whole craze that's, you know, happening in our country.
Oh,
I was actually, I stepped into H&M the other day for the first time in a long time. And I was just so disturbed, like, looking around and, there was a big poster that said all of their, like, basic tees and stuff were made sustainably.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that interesting. And I don't know at what length it is sustainable and isn't.
Yeah.
So I can't comment on that. But in terms of fast fashion versus, you know, slow fashion, do you think there's, like, an in-between, you know, or is it just kind of one or the other?
I feel like the only, there may be some in-betweens.
Yeah.
And I think are the ones that, you know, for us over here, we do made to measure. So you have to wait about 4 weeks for your clothing to be shipped.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are other companies that are probably producing much faster, or they already have the set inventory. But they're not, you know, going all the way to, they're not going overseas to get it all done.
Right. Made in America.
Made in America, t-shirts, things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is in store for Descalza? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, Descalza. Mm-hmm.
It sounds so much better when you say it. I'm just going to have you say it. Sounds so much prettier. What's your plan? Like, do you have a big vision, a big dream that you see for your company?
Yeah, so I learn about Descalza. The more I work on it, the more I guess that dream becomes more visible. Because right now I'm just kind of going with what feels right and what my customers are saying, what their feedback is, like what do they want to see. And I think now, like, the more I work on it, the more that I see, you know, this brand is a brand that celebrates, you know, being an immigrant, celebrates being a child of many cultures. It kind of gives us this space to just accept, you know, be happy with who we are, and, you know, be proud that, you know, in my case, like, I speak Spanish, I speak English, like, I speak Spanglish, and that's beautiful, and that's, you know, that's the States. You know, we've woven so many, you know, cultures and communities here, and that's what makes us so beautiful and such a unique country, is because we're coming in from all over the place.
Yeah.
And so I want to keep that going. Like, you know, I want to still, you know, have that sense of proud, you know, being proud to be here. And at the same time, you know, be able to collaborate with more artisans. Like, you know, we mentioned earlier to work with artisans from Mexico all the way to Brazil. Because I know that each of us, you know, including the Caribbean, we have our own take on textiles. And it's just a matter of somebody going in there and, you know, taking the time to really explore and find it, you know, just like in El Salvador. Like, if you go to El Salvador, you won't find it from the get-go. It's not out there as alive as it is in other countries such as Guatemala. But, you know, because of the time that I took and because of the questions that I asked, like, I was able to find this little itty-bitty town that is still preserving our heritage. And so that's one big goal, is to, you know, work with all of Latin America, and here in the States, like, work with, you know, more seamstresses, you know, have cut and sew facilities open up. Here in North Carolina, we were known as a textile state. You know, we had so many manufacturers here. So many people, you know, had a plethora of textile jobs, and my mom was included in that, and her friends. But as this concept of fast fashion kept growing, like, you know, they were shutting down, so they had to move overseas. And so now what you have left is quite a group of talented individuals who can cut, who can sew, who can drape, but they don't have the jobs. And so that's something that's important for me, is growing up and seeing my mom being laid off, seeing her friends being laid off. Like, I want to bring that back. Like, we're at a very small scale right now. My seamstresses work from their house. But I hope that we can have these facilities that, you know, will give them the space to work on Descalza, but also give them a sense of safe space. And this is a space that they could, you know, we could have workshops, community workshops. We can, you know, teach others how to sew. Like, people are always asking me, like, to teach them. And I was like, I wish I had the time. But, you know, here's a place that these talented individuals can share their talent with you. So, yeah, in sense of community, like, I just want to keep growing that way.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So if somebody wanted to order a skirt from you, they would go to your website. And how is that from start to finish? How does that design process? And, like, I know you said it's fitted, it's per order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how does that work?
Yeah, so It's very simple. Okay. I know some people can get, they can get intimidated or like, oh, I don't know how to measure myself. But what we do is you go on the website. Let's say you click on one of the skirts that you really like, and you actually have two options. One, you can select a already standard size, and then you look at the sizing chart, and if that matches your waist, then you should be good to go. I preferably, since we're making it from scratch, I usually recommend for them just to do the made-to-measure option. And so the made-to-measure option, right now our skirts only require two measurements, and that's the waist, and then the length from the waist to the floor, or the waist to your hem, depending. There's a couple of skirts that have different hemlines. And if you're not sure how to do that, there are instructions on how to measure yourself. And I think there's even like a video linked into it. So I give you all the resources I can give you that are on the website. But if you still feel hesitant, then you can always email me and we can set up some sort of chat where I'm literally watching you measure yourself, making sure that you got the right measurements. And yeah, and then you submit that in, and then I refine the pattern here. And then I send it to one of my seamstresses in Sanford in North Carolina. And she makes it. She makes the skirt. Takes her, depending on amount of orders that she's working on, it can take her as quick as 2 weeks or as long as 4 to 6 weeks. And then we ship it home to you.
Love that. Mm-hmm. That's such a fun thing. So are you just selling on your website, or do you do any wholesale? Are you in any boutiques or anything?
Not yet. So right now we just do on the website, and then we do pop-ups, you know, around the community, gone through different states and just popped up there. We're actually going to California at the end of May.
Fun.
But yeah. So, but right now it's just all through Descalza.
Well, I love that. It's such a unique experience. It's something that we're not used to having something designed specifically for our body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, like just seeing what fast fashion does and how it carries so much excess. You know, they make all of this inventory and then they can't get rid of it, and then they're just throwing it. You know, like if it's nothing. For me, you know, these fabrics take time. They're hand woven.
Yeah.
So that's one. And then two, they're expensive. Like that is not, you know, the yardage is not what you pay for if it's like a satin or any of that. It's hand woven fabric that is expensive. And so if we're going to cut and put the scissors in there, it needs to have a home. Like it needs to be going somewhere. So that's why we usually wait for the customer to, you know, put her order in. So then these fabrics have a purpose, like they're going somewhere. They're not just being made and, you know, sold or stored in some sort of closet or something waiting to find a home.
Yeah.
We want them to already have one before they get cut.
So do you have fabrics on hand, like some fabric, and then you'll order more once more orders are placed?
Yes, yeah. So we have some fabrics already on this side of town.
Yeah.
And then when it starts to run low, sometimes what I do, if it's running low, then like, okay, that's it for that pattern. Then I start to think of new products with different patterns. And then I'll talk to the artisans and we'll think of new colorways. And then I'll request those. So yeah, so we always try to get the fabrics here before the orders, just because those fabrics will take some time to get made, and I don't want the customer to have to wait, you know, 3 to 4 months for their skirt because their fabric's not in yet.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know people seem to want things sooner than later.
Yeah.
But that's what I like about what you're doing. It's something that people can look forward to. It's really different. Mm-hmm. So... Awesome. All right. So where can we find you on social media and on your website? Like, just give us some places to go.
Yeah. So if you are going straight to the website, you would just go to descalza.co.
Okay.
And then if you want to check out our social media, we're on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest. And that's just at wear, W-E-A-R, descalza.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I will post that in the show notes so that people can easily find you and yes. Order a skirt. I'm going to order a skirt. I don't yes. wear enough skirts, so you'll inspire me. So thank you so much for being here today, and we're definitely going to be following you on your journey.
Thank you guys for having me. I always enjoy having these conversations and just spreading the word about this.
Absolutely.
Here at the Fairlosophy Podcast, we recognize that we do not live in a bubble. We are all connected. There are people behind every product we shop for, and we can influence their lives when we vote with our dollar. If you like this episode, take a screenshot and share it on your social media. When you do, you'll be entered to win a giveaway that we will do live on Instagram once a month. Tag us and follow us at the Fairlosophy Podcast. Good luck.